Please call the case.
Calling case number SCWC 13-531, Arthur v. State. Arguing for the petitioner, Sato and Associates, Kevin Sumita. Arguing for the supporting respondent, Coastal, will be Michiro Iwanaga. Arguing for the respondent, KIC, will be Brad Petrus. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Sumita, Mr. Iwanaga, and Mr. Petrus. Are you all ready to proceed today? Mr. Petrus, all right. My understanding is we've allocated, the time will be allocated as follows. Mr. Sumita, you'll go for 13 minutes. A light will come on to warn you that you've reached that point. Mr. Iwanaga, you'll follow for 15 minutes. The light will come on because that will signify there's 2 minutes to go in that argument. And Mr. Sumita, you've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal, is my understanding, correct? All right. And then Mr. Petrus will give you a warning light with 5 minutes to go in your argument. All right. Mr. Sumita, please proceed with your argument.
Please, the court. I'm Kevin Sumita, private coverage counsel for petitioner Sato and Associates. We have argued that acceptance of pancakes decision will lead to exactly what happened to Pacific Fence, a defendant in this case, where a small party with no culpability is now forced to pay defense costs of a large amount to a large party who has culpability. And later in the case, that same small party who was proven to have no culpability will be forced to pay indemnity costs of the large party who is culpable.
Now, Mr. Sumita, can you just speak up a bit or into the mic so we can hear you? Thank you.
You know, we believe that the pancakes decision is wrong on the law, on the facts, and on public policy. It's wrong on the facts because the contracts of insurance are very different than the contracts of indemnity that usually appear in construction contracts. In insurance contracts, the duty of indemnification is found in a separate provision than the duty to defend. In insurance contracts, the defense obligation is expressed in broad terms, using the words fraudulent and frivolous as expressing the scope of their duty to defend, and it's for this reason that the Hawaii Supreme Court, as well as the courts around the country, have interpreted the duty of defense on the part of insurers to be separate and broader than the duty to indemnify. Whereas that is not the case in the typical indemnity contract of a construction situation where, yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Smith. You're on this point, I think, about how the indemnity clause is in conflict with HRS section 431.10.22, the construction industry indemnity agreements being invalid. The statute does specifically pass. So let me ask you if you could help me with that conflict that you're suggesting, because the statute certainly does seem to address the concern of the legislature about disparity in bargaining power, and I understand that you're concerned that your client would end up being held perhaps liable for the liability in this case that they actually hadn't committed. But with that said, what about this indemnity clause specifically seems to be contrary to the intent in the statute? That intent is to address a disparity in bargaining power, because it would seem the indemnity clause doesn't necessarily hold Sato responsible for liability that's solely the liability of the permittee.
Well, it is broader than that. We would assert, Your Honor, that the indemnity provision that is thrust upon Sato and the small contractors by KIC is very broad. But
how does this particular indemnity clause hold your client, Sato, the permittee? How does it hold your client necessarily liable for the actions of willful or negligent of, in this case, the contractor?
The unfortunate thing, Your Honor, is we haven't even gotten to the point of indemnity, because the primary dispute at this level has been whether or not Sato must pay for the defense costs of KIC. The defense costs have been interpreted, the obligation for defense costs has been interpreted by the Pancakes Court, for example, as starting at inception based upon what is called the complaint allegation rule, which is a rule that was developed in the context of insurance because of the way the insurance policies are written.
I guess the question is, does 431.10.222 apply in this case? Is there actually, does the agreement at issue purport to provide indemnity for the sole negligence of KIC, or is it rather in instances where there might be multiple forms or negligence by multiple parties? So the ICA had focused on whether the sole negligence requirement of the statute was met in this instance. What's your response on that?
I have two, Your Honor. The first is that the language of the contract is being broadly interpreted by KIC, but our response to that is to determine the duty of Sato and Associates under this contract, there must first be certain things that have occurred which show that it was in fact culpable. And until we get to that point, it has neither a duty to defend nor a duty to indemnify under the terms of the contract. Now, if the terms of the contract are so broadly written that despite reading it strictly construed, that Sato might still, under the terms of the contract, have an obligation to defend or indemnify, the statute might still come into play so that that even as so read, it is invalid. But we are not at that point because what's happened is, under the terms of pancakes, we don't even get to make those determinations. The mere fact that the word defense is used in indemnity contract automatically triggers a duty on the part of Sato and the small contracts to provide a defense.
I understand that your 431 argument is an alternative, and your first argument is based on pancakes is wrongly decided. Is my understanding correct?
Yes. In terms of the question that the Chief Justice asked, that related to the interpretation of the contract, our main argument is that the terms of the contract must be strictly construed. In terms of,
do you think that pancakes implicitly overruled this court's precedent saying that in indemnity agreements must be strictly construed against the person who is being indemnified?
I don't think overruled would be the correct term. I would say it was ignored, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court has given lots of guidance in that direction.
I have several questions. First, how do you respond? The opposition, KIC, is arguing that you, at the trial level, actually argued that you sought a defense from one of the parties and that you argued that pancakes was controlling. Is that true?
I was not present at those arguments, Your Honor.
Your prior counsel?
Actually, we're kind of co-counsel because they were hired by the insurance company to defend certain claims. The part that I'm handling is not being...
So are you saying that there was a conflict?
No, it was that there's parts that the insurance company refuses to provide a defense or indemnity for, and that's why I'm involved.
Okay, and along those lines, I have another question. You know, even the statute says this is the contract, but it doesn't affect any other insurance issues. It doesn't affect any obligation under an insurance contract. When I look at the contract between you and KIC, you have the indemnity provision. You also have an insurance clause, Sato. And Sato was required, in addition to the professional liability, comprehensive general liability, and that KIC was supposed to be listed as an additional insured. And I'm just wondering, why are we here? Was there no CGL policy?
There was a CGL policy, and to my understanding, Your Honor, KIC was listed as an additional insured. Now, this was not brief, but I can tell you, I suspect what the reason was. In the typical additional insurance endorsement, KIC would be named as an additional insured, but, quote, only with respect to the work of the subcontractor, Sato. So it's limited in that way. The indemnity contract here is much, much broader than that, and KIC is holding us to that breath.
So the CGL carrier doesn't defend KIC on that basis?
Only if there is, I'm not sure what they're doing in this case, but only with respect to, under the typical endorsement, the work of the subcontractor.
So, and I know that one of these cases, it really was, even though the parties were arguing, it really was insurance companies trying to seek reimbursement of defense costs. So that could, is that what's going on here?
I'm not sure. I think that's part of the reason. In the past, a lot of these issues did work out between insurers. But that has changed quite dramatically. We pointed out that there has been a decision by the ICA and suddenly my brain went blank that I signed that decision to the court, where insurance coverage is no longer available for these kinds of claims.
And the professional liability insurance here is a cannibalizing policy.
I'm not sure. I believe it might be, but we haven't gotten to a fight about that. So I haven't.
Because you're here, you've represented that your client is paying.
Yes.
Is paying you.
That's right, because it's not based upon a cannibalizing policy, but on the fact that the insurance company has disclaimed any coverage for the particular claims being made and for defending those particular claims.
Okay. Now, so putting aside any additional remedies that you may otherwise seek, you are here arguing that Pancakes was wrongly decided.
Yes, Your Honor. And more in follow-up to Your Honor's question, what makes it most significant about the fact that the ICA has not followed the precedent of the Supreme Court is the fact that they didn't really analyze how they got there. Basically, the entire decision of Pancakes is based upon, the entire analysis of Pancakes is based upon one sentence that says, we really don't see there to be a difference between insurance company or insurance policies and indemnity contracts, and so therefore we're just going to apply the same thing. Now,
Mr. Smita, could you follow up on that point? What about the assumption in Pancakes, essentially, that this duty to defend is meaningless if you wait until the claims have already been resolved? What about that analysis do you consider to be inconsistent at this time with, for example, the statute you're citing, 431?
Okay. Well, first of all, the duty to defend is not meaningless because if we are found to be bound to that provision of the contract and it applies, we may have to pay defense costs.
So would you concede that your position suggests that duty to defend under the indemnity clause simply means duty to pay defense costs?
In this particular instance, Your Honor, yes. There may be other instances where the factual circumstances are such that the duty to defend will trigger immediately. But where the facts are in dispute is whether or not the triggering events are there.
Do you take the position that 431 would preclude an indemnity clause that says that there's a duty to defend based on a claims made analysis?
It would preclude it if it's based upon the sole negligence of the person sought to be.
Yes, but this indemnity clause doesn't do that. It doesn't base it on the sole negligence of the contractor.
It is broader than that. That's correct.
I want to come back to Justice Wilson's comment because the language of the indemnity says defend and hold harmless. And again, in this instance, it would seem like the argument or your position is that Sato should only be required to pay defense costs once that burden or once that obligation is clear. But it appears that you're rewriting, it could be suggested you're rewriting the clause. How is it that the clause defend as opposed to payment of defense costs still has meaning under your interpretation?
Well, first of all, other courts have interpreted it exactly that way. In fact, one of the courts which has interpreted it in that way was relied upon by the Pancakes Court, that's Hillman, where there was a duty to defend, but the obligation to pay defense costs was determined afterwards because the triggering, that was triggered, the duty was not yet clearly established.
And actually, that's what California did until Crawford, correct?
I think Your Honor is correct, yeah.
And then, and Crawford in California, until Crawford, California did not require the payment of defense costs until the determination was made. But Crawford was actually based on a California statute that says that the person indemnifying is bound on request of the person indemnified to defend actions or proceedings brought against the latter in respect to the matters embraced by the indemnity. So on that basis, the California Supreme Court reversed the California Court of Appeals decisions that had said that there's no duty to pay the, you know, upfront defense costs until the determination is made. But I'm just curious, okay, so as right now you're being required to pay defense costs. KIC is not paying any defense costs now, is that right? Or is not obligated to at this point?
They are submitting, I think, invoices to my client and to other defendants. And I think there is
going in
to
percentages, right?
In some
percentage. Including a defense of their punitive damages claim against them,
yes,
alone.
Presumably so, yes.
Isn't then your argument really that if you're forced to pay defense costs up front, you're going to be in violation of this anti-indemnity statute if you're found not liable?
Yes.
And if that is the case, doesn't that, the only way it would seem that to be consistent with the statute, to be consistent with the, what the legislature wanted, would be to postpone the defense costs until there's a determination of liability?
I think that's a very reasonable way of reviewing the statute, yes.
And I can imagine that one of the big concerns would be, well, gee, if this indemnity defense is not enforced, then people are going to be sitting without a defense. Is that the actuality in these cases?
Oh, absolutely not.
Aren't these parties actually have their own insurance that provides a defense?
Yes, and in the case of KIC, you know, they're probably bigger than the insurance company that's defending them.
And actually, wouldn't it be possible that at the end of the case, when either through a settlement where people decide what the apportionments are going to be, or through a adjudication as to the liability, then the defense costs end up being allocated at that time?
Yes.
And as a practical matter, in this case, okay, I don't know what your client was paid, but I noticed that Pacific Fence seems to also be in the same boat as you. And now this case is going forward, correct?
Yes.
And they're responsible for what, 15 or 20% of the defense costs from a certain date forward, from the date of the tender to them?
Yes.
They got paid $15,000, and now they're going to, I wonder what their defense costs are now.
And they're not ever culpable at all. No culpability.
And aren't they out of business?
They're out of business.
Isn't that what the legislature is trying to prevent against?
I'm sure it was, yes. And further to the Chief Justice's question, keep in mind that the concept of making the word defense illusory, really it doesn't apply here, because we're just talking about a matter of timing. They're incurring defense costs by counsel of their choice and so forth, and then the bills are referred to us, and you pay it at some point after it's incurred. Based upon the argument the Sato is making, the after will take place a little bit more after.
But Mr. Sumito, if that's your interpretation, if what I'm hearing and have read is your position, why wasn't that spelled out in the agreement?
Under the adhesion agreement is thrust upon my client, it's a take it or leave it agreement.
What facts are there in the record that reflect that somehow, when you say thrust upon your client, are you saying that in some way or form or fashion your client was coerced in signing that agreement?
Coercion is not the concept in an adhesion contract situation. It's
basically then what exactly are you referring to when you say thrust upon your client?
The developer contractor comes, general contractor comes to a small party and says, I have this multimillion-dollar project. You can get I'll give you a piece of that. Sign this contract.
Isn't that what the legislature recognized? Is this from 1970? When was the statute first enacted?
I think it was first enacted in the 70s, John. Yes.
And that's what the legislature was concerned about?
I believe so, yes. My time is up.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Iwanaga, your argument. Could you turn off the light, I guess, at this point? Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Judge Browning, I'm Michiru Iwanaga, and I represent Coastal Construction. Coastal Construction is one of only two parties whose conduct was specifically reviewed, adjudicated, and found to be totally not responsible for Mona Arthur's fall, for her mortal injuries, and for her eventual death 3 months later. Coastal is still involved in the case, though, and has an interest in this appeal because of the indemnity clause. In particular, the various members of the court have referred to the duty to indemnify, but it is the duty to defend which is of greatest concern. Because that duty to defend, once you engage in an expansive interpretation, whether it's based on pancakes or based on what we believe to be oppressive language of the indemnity clause, results in a subcontractor, and I'm using that term to apply to design professionals or what have you, or general contractors in the relation with the developer, but imposes upon the subcontractor the obligation to stand behind not just his work, but the work of others. We feel that, quite honestly, the court, various members have asked various questions.
A high percentage of these cases settle, correct?
That's correct.
And so actually, when we talk about these cases, it's the defense costs that become astronomical, not the indemnity costs, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so actually what happens is that through these indemnity clauses, you could have the people upstream who are may actually be liable, not really worried, because they can get their defense costs covered by downstream people, correct? In terms of the policy, does that encourage the upstream people to be responsible if they're not going to be responsible for their own liability or their own work?
Discourages them from...
Because they can shift the cost down to someone else, right?
That's correct, yeah. Let me use another example. When a client comes into my office and says, I want to sue my condo association, I say, whoa, because the condo association is relatively insensitive to the cost of litigation, because they simply send out an assessment if there's no insurance for it, they send out an assessment, and you know the cost of litigation is divided into itty bits, and the association proceeds with litigation insensitive to their own exposure in the case, and behaving in a manner that is not conducive to appropriate consideration of their own fault. That is an aberrant result. Now, Justice Reckonwall spoke of rewriting the contract. We don't believe that it would result in a rewriting of the contract. It assumes, for example, that rules like the plain meaning requirement is an absolute rule that says we always apply the plain meaning of a term to the interpretation of a contract. And so, I can't recall whether Mr. Petras may have argued it on his brief, but it certainly was argued below, and it certainly will be argued in the future unless something else is done, that defense necessarily means an active defense by a warm body hired by the subcontractor. Well, Your Honor, that's not the case here. In this case, KIC did not have its attorneys stand aside. It did not require the indemnitors, the subcontractors, to go out and find an attorney to defend KIC. Instead, KIC's own original attorney remained at the helm, defending KIC and sending fee bills.
Should that make a difference, though? Should our resolution of the case depend on whether or not they hired outside counsel, or they forced you to hire counsel?
I think what importance that is that the indemnity clause is not about whether or not an active defense is provided by someone else. It has to do with money.
Well, Mr. Iwanaga, if I could interrupt you before you move from this concept of money, because you're explaining what may well happen to clients who seek your advice on an insurance contract or seek your advice about whether to sue a condo association, and there's insurance coverage, and therefore, because of the duty to defend, it's likely that the condo association isn't going to have to worry, right? Because an attorney's going to step in and represent them. And that phenomenon can occur as a result of the duty to defend as it is defined for insurance policies. Now, you're not suggesting that we change the definition of duty to defend for insurance policies. You're just suggesting that it should be different. The duty to defend should be defined differently when it comes to an indemnity contract. Correct?
Yes.
All right. So with that said, this idea that it's important now to take into consideration the costs of defense, take that into consideration, because if the costs of defense have to be borne initially with a claims-made analysis, it would be contrary to 431, right? That's your view. It'd be contrary to 431 because in a sense you'd be holding liable the contractor, the subcontractor, even though there was no liability, correct?
That's certainly one of my views.
Okay, so accepting that analysis, that's not exactly what is in 431. I mean, 431 definitely protects with the understanding that the disparity in bargaining power is important between a subcontractor and the contractor. The disparity is important, but to address it, they talk about relieving of liability. There's no language about a relieving of costs of defense or relieving of a duty to defend. This doesn't change a definition of duty to defend specifically. So you're suggesting we imply that the intent of this is to change the definition of duty to defend when it comes to...
Actually, this statute was 1970, correct? Pancakes was decided in 1997, correct? Okay, so it seems to me the issue really is, until Pancakes, in indemnity contracts, this court had said the law of contracts prevails. And in an indemnity contract, it's strictly construed against the person who is seeking indemnity. That's what the law was. Pancakes comes out and says, we see no reason to distinguish the duty to defend in a indemnity contract from insurance law. We see no reason to, even though insurance contracts say, we will indemnify you for this, and there's a separate clause that says, we will defend you on everything, even if it's fraudulent. It's a separate clause. Pancakes says we see no reason to not incorporate insurance principles to the weaker party. Do you see the logic behind that in terms of this court? And courts have said, you know, insurance companies are in the business of providing insurance. They have a separate duty to defend, which is broader than the duty to indemnify. In this case, we have a clause that says, you know, Sato shall indemnify, hold harm, and defend and hold harmless for work arising out of our negligence.
If I may answer.
Our negligence. But without our negligence being determined, now applying insurance principles, you're required to defend?
I believe I can.
Let me ask you this. Pancakes, do you think it was actually necessary for the ICA to say that insurance defense obligations under insurance contracts apply? Because I see the clause under ordinary contract principles in Pancakes as quite different. In Pancakes, the clause said, except for my willful misconduct or gross negligence, you, Pomare, shall defend, indemnify, defend, and hold me harmless. Except where it's found that I am grossly negligent, you have to defend me. It starts off by saying, I'm your agent. You know, I am your agent. And except where, unless I'm found grossly negligent, you have to defend me. Whereas our clause says, I have to pay you if I'm found negligent. Isn't that different?
Well,
isn't it under normal, ordinary contract principles, construing the contract, isn't that different?
Well, the court has made Your Honor has made a number of points. The first point, having to do with the propriety or logic of Pancakes, I think dovetails on the flip side with Justice Wilson's remark about interpreting the Hawaii's anti-indemnity statute. My answer to both is that my view is that the court need not interpret and thereby apply the anti-indemnity statute. Instead, the anti-indemnity statute reflects a legislative finding that in construction-related cases, indemnity clauses such as these are tainted with superior bargaining party power on the part of the party extracting the indemnity, and that would also apply to the defense. So we don't.
Well, that's not what the statute says. The statute refers to liability. It doesn't refer to defensive costs.
If you look, that's correct. But if you look at the findings in the preamble to the original bill, they talk about general contractors, owners, and the like, extracting these indemnities by imposing them on a take-it-or-leave-it basis.
So let me ask to clarify. Are you arguing, and maybe I missed this previously, but are you arguing that these are invalid as adhesion contracts, period, and it actually, or are you arguing the way this is worded in this specific contract, that it's going to be narrowly read and therefore it's not going
to... The closest would be to the latter, Your Honor.
But that means then the what would happen then, I think you're saying, if then it would have been okay if these would have been in separate provisions in the contract. So, for example, if we were to rule as you're arguing, then tomorrow what would happen is they would be in separate provisions in the contract and that would be okay.
No, Your Honor. We're saying that the defense provision should simply be construed along with the indemnity clause, and that the obligation to defend is simply an obligation to indemnify against defense costs arising from claims relating to the subcontractor's work.
Okay. Does that render superfluous the idea of even putting the word defend into this contract? Why not just say hereby agrees to indemnify?
As I mentioned,
could we silence that, please? Thank you.
You can
respond to the question.
As I mentioned, the rule regarding application or use of the plain meaning of a term is not absolute.
So you're suggesting the plain meaning of the term indemnify doesn't include the concept of indemnifying for the cost of defense?
No. I'm saying that unlike the situation of insurance policy, defend does not include uncovered claims, and defend means a duty to indemnify at the end of the case.
But it sounds like you're making my argument for me when you say that duty to defend essentially means an aspect of indemnification.
That's correct, and it addresses a point that Justice McKenna made when she referred to California law. The California statute modified the common law. The common law is, as I understand it, is if you say, I agree to indemnify you against all losses arising from my behavior, it doesn't include defense costs. So by requiring
Well, this clause has defense, so I don't think that gets you anywhere.
I believe it does.
The issue is, no, California law was, and other jurisdictions also hold that you don't do it. The obligation doesn't arise until the actual liability is determined. That's when you pay, after the percentage of liability is determined.
I will not disagree with that. With an opinion that is in.
Yeah. Okay, my question then is your argument that defense costs are coextensive with indemnity in all contracts or only construction contracts? What rule are you asking us to
come? Only in construction.
And why are you arguing only in construction contracts? Isn't the only response because of the anti-indemnity statute?
That and the principal purpose of an indemnity clause, and that is, in the case of construction, have the subcontractor stand behind his work. And when we apply a different rule, we get exactly the kind of distortions where people upstream skate on their defense costs and act irrationally in the course of the litigation. And maybe that's why this case has languished on, unresolved, through settlement for over 10 years.
Very well. Now we'll hear from Mr. Petras.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice.
Good morning.
Justices of the Court, Judge Browning. May it please the Court, Brad Petras on behalf of defendant, third-party plaintiff appellee, and writ respondent, Kamehameha Investment Corporation, to whom everyone's been referring to as KIC this morning. The Court has raised a number of different issues, all of which I will get to, but basically this case boils down to two questions. Does the complaint allegation rule apply to the duty to defend under indemnity provision contained in a non-insurance contract? And secondly, do the allegations that were set forth in the plaintiff's complaint in this case trigger a duty on the part of SOPTA to defend KIC under the project consultant agreement between KIC and SOTO for the Kalawahine Street site project. So dealing with the first question with regards to the complaint allegation rule, this court previously cited with approval the Pancakes decision in the Haole 4 versus State of Hawaii case.
It wasn't a holding, though, was it?
That's correct. It wasn't dicta, but the court did identify the Pancakes case as authority, as guidance, not authority, but as guidance for how to interpret indemnity provisions, specifically as it deals with the duty to defend
a state governmental entity, and there are several statutes in which entities or parties are statutorily required to indemnify the state.
That's correct. That case was handled under an administrative rule pursuant to the Department of Transportation and the Enabling Authority. The court ultimately did hold that the Department of Transportation had exceeded its authority, but nonetheless, the court did cite with approval the Pancakes decision for the proposition.
Do you think Pancakes was correct? The Pancakes court was correct in saying that we see no reason to treat indemnity clauses differently from insurance contracts? Do you agree with that proposition?
I don't think that that's what the Pancakes case was, court was dealing with. The Pancakes court was not dealing with the question of indemnity. It was dealing with the question of the duty to defend.
Right, duty to defend. And we see no reason to treat this differently, a commercial contract differently from insurance contracts.
That's how the Pancakes court did rule. It borrowed from the law that had developed in the context of insurance and applied it to a non-insurance contract.
But did that have the effect of changing the presumptions that we ordinarily apply to indemnity contracts?
I don't think it does. The vast majority of jurisdictions that have looked at the question of the duty to defend under a non-insurance contract applying general contract principles.
Vast majority?
Yes.
How many?
I don't know the exact number, but the cases that have been cited both.
4 to 5?
I don't know the exact number, Your Honor, as I indicated, but the case law, I would stand, definitely supports the proposition that general contract principles hold that the duty to defend is separate from the duty to indemnify in a non-insurance contract.
Didn't Haole say, and was talking about the complaint rule, it said something about, this is so because the duty to defend extends only to claims for which the promisor might be liable. If no liability can possibly exist, there is no duty to defend.
Correct. If
but your argument is that they have a duty to defend, even though they might not be found liable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Pacific Fence has a duty to defend.
It did,
even though all it did was put up a fence according to specs.
Yes, that
had no idea that your client had not told SOTO, apparently, that the owners, the purchasers, were going to have to maintain the hillside.
Well, Your Honor.
Had no idea that DHHL had lowered the height of the fence from 4 feet to 2 feet.
Your Honor, first, that's not an accurate reflection of the record down below.
Okay.
If you look at the record, actually there is evidence to suggest that SOTO was aware of the fact that the homeowners had a responsibility for maintenance of the hillside.
Okay.
And in fact was asked to comment upon the lowering of the fence in light of its knowledge regarding the declarations that required the homeowners to maintain the hillside.
Okay, so potential, but there is also no dispute that KIC did call on the owners to maintain that steep hillside, correct?
The provisions of the DCCNRs require that the homeowners maintain the hillside so as not to impair the natural flow of water, so as to create a danger of water damage to the properties down below the hillside.
Mr. Petras, was this agreement thrust upon SOTO by
There's
your client?
There's nothing in the record down below, Judge Browning, that number one, this contract was not negotiable, that this particular provision of the contract was not negotiable. There's nothing in the record below to support any such contention.
Go ahead, Judge Browning.
No, I was just going to ask, how do you answer then the basic legislative history with respect to Section 431 that talks about the imbalance of power? Logically, if it applies to indemnity, doesn't it apply to also the obligation to defend as well?
Your Honor, I have several responses to that particular question. Number one, the statute itself does not refer to defend. It speaks only in terms of the duty to indemnify. There are statutes, for example, in Arizona, New Mexico, and Washington State, all of which include the word defend in their anti-indemnity statute that applies to construction contracts. The Massachusetts court in Herson versus New, it's the Herson case. In that case, they were interpreting the Massachusetts anti-indemnity statute, and they held that since it didn't have the word defend, that must have been intentional and therefore only applied when you get to the question of indemnity. Secondly, the anti-indemnity statute in Hawaii provides that an agreement which purports to obligate the indemnitor to indemnify the indemnity for damages resulting from the sole negligence of the indemnity is against public policy and be void and unenforceable. The contract between KIC and Sato did not purport and does not obligate Sato to indemnify KIC for any damages or injuries resulting from the sole negligence of KIC.
What about for the defense costs for defending against a punitive damage provision? Are they responsible?
They're responsible for the defense, Your Honor, yes. Ultimately, not as to any indemnification.
And you think that's consistent with the purpose of the anti-indemnity statute to make, even though you're not responsible for liability, you're responsible for the defense costs, which might greatly exceed the liability?
Well, Your Honor, I have several responses to that particular question. Number one, the IC actually held that KIC is responsible for a portion of its own defense, and it ruled that it would be done on a pro rata basis. So therefore,
what proportion?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What proportion?
That would depend upon the number of parties who have a defense obligation, and depending upon the time of tender. At various points in time, there were four different parties participating in the defense of KIC. At various points in time, there were five. If you adopt the ICA's decision about KIC also being responsible for a portion of its own defense, at various points in time, KIC would have been responsible for anywhere from 1/4 to 1/6 of its own defense.
When the legislature passed this law, one of the things that they mentioned was that these types of indemnity clauses were requiring contractors to pay insurance. Their insurance costs were going up 300% to 400%, and requiring them to run the risks of exposing their assets to uninsured losses caused by the negligence of third parties. Do you think that requiring these contractors to pay the defense costs upstream comports with the legislature's intent to try to keep the insurance costs of these contractors down, and as well as in terms of what I mentioned before, the public policy of encouraging people to take responsibility for their own actions, whatever their actions may be?
Your Honor, dealing with the second part of that question, I think the purpose of indemnity provisions and defense provisions, such as the one we have that we're reviewing today, is to shift to the party that's actually doing the work the risk associated with their work. For example, Sato was responsible for the civil engineering design. They're the ones best situated to identify the risks associated with their own work. The contractors are best situated to assist the risk associated with their own work. Therefore, the object of these types of provisions is to shift to the party who's actually performing the services or the work the responsibility for claims that might arise out of their work.
Did Coastal get a refund?
Did
they get a refund? The parties that have been found not liable.
They settled with Coastal on the duty to defend issue.
If there's a settlement, then maybe I...
Does requiring all of these fights about defense costs... Wasn't there a lot of litigation, or is obviously there is, but wouldn't it be much simpler to go back to the law? I don't know if we don't specifically have a case in Hawaii, but there are jurisdictions that clearly hold that, well, you go, first of all, you go by the contract, but the contract terms is what governs. But if it's unclear, it's construed against the indemnity, and then when you have these clauses that it's one sentence, it's the defense is construed to be identical to the indemnity liability, and how you do that is to determine at the end, when it's determined, that's when we have to pay, reimburse the defense costs.
Your Honor, all that does is to convert the duty to defend into the duty to indemnify. And our position is those are two separate and distinct obligations.
Don't parties actually buy insurance for the defense costs?
Yes, Your Honor, they do.
And then, isn't it, but then there are sometimes parties that don't have sufficient insurance, correct?
Well, there's a couple aspects of that particular question. And number one, I don't think Mr. Iwanaga or Mr. Sumita would deny the fact that their clients are being defended in the underlying case by insurance companies. Secondly, Your Honor, the defense obligation for KIC
so is when being Mr. Sumita has says that he's paying his client is paying him directly, that's not true. You're
that,
saying
that may be true as Mr. Sumita, but his co-counsel is being defended by an insurance policy. Also, Your Honor, there's this argument that these claims aren't covered under standard liability policies. There are what is referred to as the insured contract.
Who would pay for these defense costs? Is it his client or is it his client's insurer?
Sato's defense costs are being paid by Sato's insurance.
The defense costs that they are being held liable for, your defense costs, who pays that? Sato, the company, or Sato's insurer?
That's between him and his insurance company. But what I was about to say, Your Honor, there are provisions.
So that's where he's arguing that the contractual liability exclusion would not allow for coverage of your defense costs.
I don't know what his insurance policies say or don't say, but I do know that readily available commercial general liability policies, as well as professional liability policies, contain what are called the insured contract exception to the contractual liability exclusion. And those particular that coverage provides coverage specifically for indemnity obligations obtained through an indemnity provision in a non-insurance contract. In this case, Your Honor, I think it's important to recognize when we originally tendered to Sato and to Kiewit, they both accepted the tender on a pro rata basis. They reserved their right to later contest it. Their insurance companies were going to pay my client. It wasn't going to be the actual indemnitors named in the contracts. It was their insurance companies. And I don't recall which of the justices raised the question as to who's paying a lot of the bills here. But basically, it is insurance companies. It's not the individuals, because there is coverage that is available for providing coverage for indemnity obligations under non-insurance contracts. And in fact, the delay, if you will, in getting this case settled has been trying to shuffle between the different insurance companies who's responsible for what. It's not really an issue of whether or not a particular indemnitor has a duty to defend. It's really a question of whether the insurance companies are going to step up to plate to honor the indemnification obligations that these parties have incurred through their contracts.
Mr. Petrus, while you've got a bit of a pause there, maybe I could ask you to clarify this position I think you're taking, which is the concern of the legislature with respect to the disparity in bargaining power, I think, is reflected in 431, right? That's their concern.
Correct.
And the position that's being taken, I think, by Sato is that for that public policy consideration to be valid, the duty to defend cannot be based on a complaint allegation rule. So can you respond to that? How is it that applying the complaint allegation rule wouldn't affect this disparity in bargaining power in a manner that would be providing additional leverage against the subcontractor?
Your Honor, number one, I don't think 431 applies to the duty to defend to begin with. If the legislature is concerned that indemnity or defense obligations are being somehow being imposed upon parties with less bargaining power, then it's for the legislature to enact a law that says that. I think the court should also take a look at the Hawaii Supreme Court case in Espaniola versus Caudy Mars. In that case, the court was asked to examine a provision within a construction contract relating to an indemnity. And in that particular case, the court examined whether the indemnity provision in that contract violated 431.10.222. And the court looked at the language of the indemnity that was operative there and said, no, this doesn't violate the statute. It doesn't purport to obligate the indemnitor to indemnify the indemnity for the indemnity's sole negligence. So on the face of the indemnity provision in Espaniola, the court said there's no violation of the statute. The same holds here. You look at the provision of the project consultant agreement, paragraph 7, which is the indemnity provision. It doesn't purport to obligate Sato to indemnify KIC for KIC's sole negligence. It specifically says that Sato is only responsible to indemnify KIC in the event that Sato is in whole or in part at fault.
Please go ahead.
Well, if I could just come back to the issue of the contract interpretation, should we construe this contract against the indemnity?
Your Honor.
Meaning KIC.
I don't think you should.
Why not? We had this line of cases which seems to suggest that we should construe these kinds of indemnity contracts against the indemnity, and the suggestion is that Pancakes has turned that around. And my question is, do you think that should we interpret these contracts against the indemnity, and if not, why not?
Your Honor, several things. Number one, the cases that dealt with the issue of construing indemnity provisions against the indemnity was where there was an obligation to indemnify the indemnity for its portion of any fault. That's where they said that you should be construing them against the indemnity. But again, I come back to this issue. What Pancakes was dealing with was the duty to defend, not the duty to indemnify. The rulings of the Hawaii Supreme Court that dealt with how you construe indemnification dealt with the issue of indemnification, not the duty to defend. I believe that the duty to defend should be interpreted based upon general contract principles. What do the parties agree to? What Sato agreed to do was to defend KIC with regards to claims, allegations, actions, and lawsuits.
So if I understand, you're saying no presumption if it's maybe a presumption in the case of indemnity, but no presumption in the case of duty to defend? And why would that make sense to have a different standard?
Because we're talking about two different things. The duty to defend is something.
I get that they're two different things. Why does it make sense to say you would construe a liability provision against the indemnity, but not the duty to defend?
Your Honor, I believe it makes sense because we're basically coming down to the interpretation of contract and what tools or what are we going to use to interpret a contract.
But Pancakes was based on insurance law saying, you know, the duty to defend is really, really broad. And so, therefore, we're going to apply insurance defense obligations to this commercial contract, even though this court's case law had been very clear that these clauses are to be construed against the indemnity. So Pancakes did turn the law around and applied insurance principles to commercial contracts.
It applied insurance principles that relates to the duty to defend, I will agree. It didn't deal with the issue of indemnity.
And in doing so, the ICA said we see no reason not to apply it. But aren't there many ways in which an insurance contract duty to defend is really different from indemnity clauses in commercial contracts?
I will agree that ultimately the duty to defend, yes, is different than the duty to indemnify. But with regards to I guess I'm a little confused as to what you're asking.
Why should the principles upon which, first of all, the contract, insurance contracts, which have a separate duty to defend, which is much broader than the duty to indemnify. That's in the contract. But besides which, the courts have construed these ambiguities against the insurer, because the insurer is in the business of providing insurance. This is what they do. These are adhesion contracts. I recognize that there's no evidence as to an adhesion contract, but they're the ones with the purse strings. Under these circumstances now, we are saying, you know, the purpose of these contracts in which these indemnity clauses are included, the principal purpose is not to provide an indemnity. The principal purpose is to get that work done. And despite the fact that there's no showing that this is an adhesion contract, I think it appears that we see the same clause in various contracts that you've entered into with various parties here, so it seems to be your standard contract. And and we do have cases saying indemnity clauses in non-insurance contract, not in this jurisdiction, but in other jurisdictions, are construed against coverage, because the agreement creates duties that differ or extend those beyond those established by general principles of, you know, contractual liability. And it seems that why would we just construe a duty to defend in an indemnity clause in these types of contract against the indemnitor? Why?
I'm not saying to construe it against the indemnitor. I'm saying,
isn't that what we're doing now? Didn't the trial court apply pancakes in making this ruling?
The circuit court did rely upon pancakes. That's correct, Your Honor.
Shouldn't these contracts be subject to ordinary contract principles?
I believe that to be the case, yes.
And isn't an ordinary contract principles that contracts of indemnity are construed against the indemnity?
When it comes to the issue of indemnification, that's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about applying ordinary contract principles to this provision of the contract that we have called the indemnity clause. Help me with the definition of defend in this clause. If it means that there's no duty to defend until the case is resolved and the claims are resolved, what meaning does defend have in that clause where it says consultant engineer hereby agrees to indemnify, defend, and hold harmless developer and each of its officers? What meaning does defend have if it's interpreted to mean duty to defend doesn't attach until the claims have been resolved?
It would have no meaning, Your Honor, because if you had to wait until the resolution of the case, then what you're converting the duty to defend into is a duty to indemnify.
But it's not an indemnity for liability. It's indemnity. It's for the defense costs. You're not transforming it. You're just determining a different time frame as to when you have to pay for the defense costs.
What's our position?
On our attorney's fees provisions, do we require that the attorney's fees continuously be provided while they're being incurred?
No, Your Honor, we don't. But that's because this particular contract obligated SOCTO to defend up front, not wait until after an adjudication on the merits. And the Crawford case is a very good example, the one that you cited to, Your Honor. I do agree that there were elements of California statutory law that were part of the analysis. But nonetheless, the Crawford case held that the duty to defend is based upon the allegations in the complaint, based upon general contract principles. And ultimately, in that case, Weathershield, the party that had the duty to defend, was found by the jury to have no liability, yet the California Supreme Court said that it still had a duty to defend, and it actually ended up dealing with this issue of allocation amongst multiple defendants. It did hold that under certain circumstances, in the discretion of the trial court, it could wait until the end to determine how to proportion the duty to defend if the parties couldn't agree. What the ICA did in our case was basically say, we're going to do it on a pro rata basis, which makes a lot of sense. Because in cases like this, when you're dealing with the duty to defend, a lot of the issues are intermingled. And the only way to equitably allocate the cost of defense is to do it on a proportionate basis. The ICA also felt in its opinion that KIC has an obligation to participate in that defense, and we have not taken issue with that particular ruling of the ICA in this case.
If we interpret this as a contract provision, I understand it just appears that the ultimate purpose of this is to hold the developer harmless for the negligence of the subcontractor, and that seems to me can be accomplished fully by paying for liability and defense costs. I mean, that's the objective, to hold the person harmless for the negligence of another person. And I don't see why the timing of it should be required at a specific time frame if the objective is to hold harmless.
I disagree with the interpretation when it comes to the question of the defense. The defense, the issue of ultimate liability, is not a question. That's not an issue. That's not how you determine whether there's a duty to defend. The duty to defend is determined based upon the allegations in the complaint, not upon an ultimate determination of responsibility or liability.
When an insurance company defends, they choose the attorney. They tend to control certain aspects of the litigation. In this case, these companies are required to pay with no ability to control any part of the litigation, the defense costs that are being incurred, and are just being instructed to reimburse, correct?
That's not correct, Your Honor. Nothing prevented Sato, Kiewit, Pacific Fence, or any of the other ones to present to KIC defense counsel for them. There's nothing in this indemnity provision that says that KIC can select counsel. What happened here, Your Honor, a tender was made. My office was already representing KIC. Kiewit and Sato came back and said, okay, we will agree that Mr. Petras can continue to defend KIC and we will participate in that defense on a pro rata basis, subject to them being ultimately having the ability to contest that in court. But they elected to pay my fees.
So should they be stopped from raising these arguments here?
I've not contested their ability to raise these issues based upon the fact that they had promised to contribute towards.
So you're not arguing estoppel?
I'm arguing estoppel that at the circuit court level, it's two things. Number one, when we actually brought a motion, they didn't contest the applicability of Pancakes of Hawaii. What they asked for the circuit court to do was to find that Sato only had a pro rata apportionment of the defense obligation and that KIC should be included in that pro rata application. The other thing that...
Wait, I'm confused. You said that they initially agreed to pay pro rata?
Correct.
And at the circuit court, they said we should only pay pro rata?
Correct.
And what is the dispute then? They were not happy with the percentage of pro rata that they had to pay here?
In part because they were saying that KIC should also be included in that calculation of the pro rata.
And so the beef, that you're not paying any, but I thought you are paying a portion.
Well, based on the ICA's ruling, we've not contested the ICA's determination that, in fact, KIC should be paying a portion of its own.
But in the circuit court, KIC was not ordered to pay a portion.
And to more fully state it, as I understand what was happening, Sato wanted you to pay a pro rata share of your own defense costs for separate allegations against you for your own negligence and willful conduct. That was their argument.
That was the basis for their argument. That's correct, Your Honor.
So they've changed their argument here.
That's correct.
The authority that you're arguing, I'm sorry, that you're referring.
One more point, if I could, Your Honor. Sato itself brought its own motion against Coastal Construction, asking that Coastal, based upon the Pancakes decision, defend Sato. And it said that the controlling law in Hawaii is Pancakes.
But what? That's the position they felt that they may have had to take because Pancakes may have been the controlling law, and now they're arguing that it should be overturned.
It's an inconsistent position, as far as I'm concerned, to say on one hand we don't have a duty to defend, but on the other hand we do.
Are you arguing estoppel or not?
I am, Your Honor.
You're arguing Crawford as well.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But isn't the agreement in Crawford different from the agreement in this case?
The language is a little bit different. I won't deny the fact that there are a variety of different indemnity provisions that are out there. There was a different contract between us and the state, which obligated us to defend and indemnify the state. There were different contract language between us and Kiewit and Coastal as distinguished from the contract language that was in the design professional contracts. I will acknowledge that the Crawford language was different, but I don't think the differences change the fact that the duty to defend under the indemnity provision that's operative vis-a-vis KIC and Sato still obligated it to defend claims and lawsuits irrespective of the ultimate determination of liability.
And your position is a duty to defend for an indemnity clause is the same as a duty to defend an insurance contract?
I would say that we can analogize to insurance law. For example, in the Tata Ocean versus State of Vermont case, the Vermont Supreme Court held that it wasn't going to incorporate wholesale insurance principles into the duty to indemnify. However, it did say that there are certain principles that have been developed in the insurance context that are helpful for making determinations.
How would you distinguish the duty to defend for an indemnity clause versus the duty to defend an insurance contract?
I would basically say what you do in the non-insurance context is you just look at the language. What does the language of the provision say? If it says you defend for claims, lawsuits, and actions, that means that that's what you defend. You don't have to incorporate various presumptions, if you will, that might be operative in the insurance context.
Mr. Petras, you've gone over your time, but we've been asking questions throughout this time you reserved. So if you'd like to wrap up at this point, I'm also going to give Mr. Samita a brief time to rebut. So feel free to wrap up before we move on to him.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have anything more to add. I think that the language of the indemnity provision in the contract between KIC and Sato is clear and not ambiguous. I think that the authority overwhelmingly supports the proposition that the duty to defend is not coextensive with the duty to indemnify, and that the complaint allegation rule should be applied to indemnity provisions in the non-insurance contract. And I appreciate the court's consideration of our position in this regard.
Thank you, Mr. Petras. Mr. Samita, you may rebut briefly.
Thank you. Very briefly. With respect to the question about the statute not referring to the duty to defend, we have briefed the court on the issue of remedial statute. This is a remedial statute, and therefore it must be interpreted broadly to effect its remedial purposes. And to say that that it's against public policy to cover as an indemnity basis the negligence of the general, but it's not against public policy to cover the defense costs, which, as the court noted, Justice McKenna noted, might be even more onerous than indemnity costs. To me, that is just completely a perversion of the statute and
then,
the statute.
Mr. Samita, then you'd concede, in the absence of 431, that the defend term and the indemnity clause should be interpreted on the basis of a complaint allegation?
No, absolutely not. The complaint allegation rule is an insurance concept that is based upon the unique provisions of the insurance contract.
So you make that argument separate from the effect of the statute?
Yes. Absolutely. The statute just gives us further reason to suspect the rationale of pancakes as it applies, as it tries to say indemnity contracts are the same as insurance contracts, because for so many different reasons that Justice McKenna pointed out, they're very different, and the statute is but one of the very important reasons why they're different.
Mr. Samita, could you clarify exactly what relief you're seeking? In other words, as I understood it, based on the ICA's ruling, the ICA has ruled that there be a pro rata share paid by KIC, and what outcome do you seek that would differ from the approach that the ICA took?
Okay, first of all, if I can preface that, we're not, the estoppel type of argument to me has no sense, because we are bound until this court rules otherwise. We're bound by pancakes, and so for Sato to have tried to argue otherwise would have been crazy. The lower court was bound by it. We were bound by it. The only opportunity we had to challenge pancakes was at the level of the ICA, where we did that, and now at this level. Now, in applying the pancakes decision, KIC took the position that all of its indemnity costs are to be covered, that it is pays nothing. That issue was litigated, and then the ICA, based upon a rationale which I don't quite fully follow, did some kind of apportionment. The apportionment is based upon the number of individuals or indemnities involved, or indemnitors involved, not based upon their respective culpability. So to the question that KIC is now being defended for even its punitive exposure. That is still true. That defense obligation is now being shared by multiple parties, but it is still being passed on to other parties besides itself. Our position is that this, because the ICA has basically untethered itself from the law, and it's come up with this proportionate share of liability without a real rational basis for it. My position is that we should go back to the law and interpret the contract provision strictly and against the person to be indemnified, and based upon that interpretation, let's figure out what the result should be.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Semita. I'm trying to understand your idea of applying contract principles to this contract. And again, looking at the word defend, if you aren't looking at the public policy implications that come from 431, why is it that your position is that a clear contract interpretation would mean that defend in that sentence only applies when the claims have already been litigated? In other words, there's no defense of the claims in the sense of defending them while they're being asserted. The word defend turns into the idea of defense costs.
Two responses. The first is that if the word defense was not there, then there would be a very good argument that we wouldn't even have to pay defense costs, because the word indemnity has come to mean we pay for whatever you have to pay for indemnity. So the word defense does have meaning. Now, whether it applies at the beginning, when you have to pay for defense costs as they incur, or later on, really will depend upon the contract. I have admitted that there may be circumstances where the factual situation is clear enough that the defense obligation begins at that moment. But where the factual allegations are not clear enough, then we cannot determine when the defense obligation begins until the factual prerequisites that are specified in the contract are required. Now, to give a silly example, if the indemnity contract said when the moon turns blue, you know, you have to defend, you know, then we have to do a factual investigation as to when that occurred. Okay? And if it's very clear that it turned blue at that particular date, that is the date the defense costs begin. If there is a factual dispute as to when that occurred, we wait until the end, have a factual determination as to that event. So the interpreting the contract strictly, we look at what are the prerequisites for the duty as stated in that contract.
And in this case, the trial court found that the defense obligations began on the date of tender.
Based upon the complaint allegation rule
only. Based on the complaint allegation and based on insurance law principles.
That's correct.
So following up on the Chief Justice's question, what is the remedy that you are seeking here?
The remedy we are seeking is to remand this case back to the circuit court for determination as to how this contract should be interpreted based upon normal contract laws.
Now, overturning that portion of Pancakes that said that these clauses of defense obligations are determined under insurance principles.
That's correct. And keep in mind that we have a variety of contracts involved here. Many parties have signed different contracts, and the court cannot apply a single complaint allegation rule to all of them. He has to look at each of the various provisions of the contract, apply the law, which has to review each contract term, each of those contracts strictly, and see how they apply. The result might be different from party to party and contract to
because
contract.
Because depending, under normal contract principles, you may even have parallel evidence that comes in to ascertain what the intent of the parties was as to the indemnity clause.
That's correct.
That might not be clear.
That's correct. And with respect to evidence about adhesion, I think the court has always been willing to find that there is an adhesion situation when you have a vast disparity in the size of the parties. Most of the cases where the courts find that there is an adhesion contract with insurance companies don't bother to do an evidentiary finding. They say, big insurance company, small insured, it must be adhesion. Well, that's what we find here. We have the gigantic KIC, and we have Sato Associates. And I don't think the court has to go any further than to presume that this is an adhesion.
But that's not quite true, according to Mr. Petras.
Yes.
We're talking about a dispute between insurance companies as opposed to a small firm like Sato versus a big contracting and development firm like
it KIC. It's definitely not a dispute between insurance companies. My client has me involved in this case because the insurance company is not paying for the contractual obligation.
So you would dispute his characterization of that?
Yes, because I am here.
I get that. But, I mean, you're here on behalf of Sato, or you're here and being paid or representing the insurance company behind Sato?
I was hired privately by Sato. I am fighting with the insurance company. They are not paying me. They're not paying Sato for my services.
Thank you.
Anything further to wrap up at this time, Mr. Samita?
No, that's all I have.
All right, very well. Thank you to all of our attorneys today for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement.